Brother Sean read the passage that we're going to be looking at today. What I'd like to do as we begin is give you a little bit of a review. Now, I realize that most of you, or the majority of you anyway, here were not able to be in our conference this weekend, and I don't want you to feel like you're sort of left out of the group or out of the sweep of what we've been doing. We did spend an awful lot of time yesterday, beginning at 9 in the morning, ending about 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. So we did invest quite a bit of time in various passages in the Scripture. So what I would like to do is give you sort of a panoramic overview of what we dealt with yesterday and bring you to the text that we're going to be looking at this morning from 1 Corinthians chapter 7 that Sean read. We covered most of that, but there's still a very significant part of that text that still needs to be covered to sort of wrap things up and bring things to a conclusion. For the first 2 hours yesterday morning, we looked at Genesis chapter 2, verses 18 through 25. And that is the creation of the family. It's the creation of marriage. It's the establishment of God's pattern, of God's plan, of God's design for one man, for one woman, for life. That is where it happened. And one of the points that we made that I think bears repeating and is very significant is not only who was put in the garden, but who was not put in the garden. Because from the very beginning, this is clearly God's pattern and model for Christian marriage. He put a man and a woman, an adult and an adult, one male, one female. And it would be easy for us to say he didn't put two men or two women. So that's almost without, I mean, you get the point. It's not, it wasn't a homosexual relationship he established in the garden. It was a relationship between a female and a male. But he also didn't put a parent and a child in the garden. That's not the priority. He didn't put an aunt and an uncle and a nephew and a niece in the garden. He didn't put a grandparent and a grandchild in the garden. He didn't put an adult and a pet in the garden, in all due respect. So he established the priority relationship for life in the garden at creation. That's his design. He did it on the sixth day of creation and basically put a period at the end of that sentence. That established it for all time. Not subject to man's readjustments, not subject to man's reassessments, not subject to man's whims and wishes, not subject to sociological theories of how cavemen got tired of running around trying to figure out whose these little babies were and where they belonged. And finally they just got fed up and said, listen, you know, Ugg, you take those, Bog, you take those, and we'll just sort of, you know, create some kind of social structure here. So all of that is just sort of washed and flushed down the toilet when we see in Genesis chapter 2 how God said it was going to be. Now, we took 2 hours to say all of that yesterday. So we've filled it in with a few other details and a few other verses from that text, but that is essentially what it is, that God established marriage. He said it was good. He designed it to be a commitment that was permanent. He designed it to be a covenant of companionship, because one of the key phrases in Genesis chapter 2 in that passage is that God said it's not good that man be by himself. So I'm going to solve that problem, and I'm going to create for him a helper that's meet, suitable, and complementary to him. Because after all, God had paraded all of the animals in front of Adam, and wouldn't you know it, he didn't find a companion. All of the animals had one. He had the privilege of naming them all. And at the end of that process, it was very clear that I'm not part of that design. There's something different for me Mr. Evolutionist. There's something different for me from the animal kingdom. They have life, but no soul. I've got both. And my soul is going to live eternity. The animal kingdom, they don't have an eternal soul. And there's a lot more we could say about that, but there is a clear distinction between what God did when he created the animals and what God did when he created man. There is the issue of leaving and cleaving. God made that part of that integral model of family. Even though at that time there was no mother and father to leave, he made that part of the dynamic of the family. And he said, when this perpetuates itself, how that happens is that the man leaves his parents, the woman leaves her parents, they form a new family. Now under the authority of God, and all of the authority that existed before between parent and child is cut off, disconnected, and no longer exist. That's hard sometimes for the parents who have leaving children to get a hold of. That's hard sometimes for the children who have left to get a hold of. But that's God's design. A new household, disconnected from the former, new authority, not subject to the former, an adult relationship with those parents equal to the former. There is no little Johnny, little Sally, you do what I say still, I don't care what your husband says, I don't care what your wife's desires are, you still do what mommy and none of that. That's gone. That's over. And this adult relationship, this covenant of companionship, it's consummated by the exchange of vows before God and those witnesses. So we spent the first 2 hours yesterday morning laying that foundation, digging down as deeply as we thought necessary in that Genesis text, in order to establish for us the foundation of everything, because if we were going to talk about divorce, if we were going to talk about remarriage, if we were going to talk about these issues, then we had to first of all establish what is it that divorce breaks, and if possible, how does that happen? Then we moved into 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and we began in verse 1, and we worked our way all the way down through verse 11. Now, for sake of time, I just want to do a very quick review to bring you up to speed on where we are. And this is how Paul has broken down this particular section of Scripture, with a little bit of background. When Sean read the text a few minutes ago, I don't know if you caught it, but it's a very important component of this overall text, and that is the very first phrase in verse 1, concerning the things that you wrote to me. So there was a letter that was sent from the Corinthian church to the Apostle Paul. We do not have a copy of that letter. It's evident that a letter was written. It's evident that questions were asked. It's evident that concerns were expressed in those questions, because as we work our way down through this passage, Paul deals with at least seven different categories of redemptive relationships. After salvation, this is what's going on, and Paul indicates by his answers and responses that there were a lot of questions. And you can imagine the questions that may have been asked after these people were converted out of a life of abject slavery and sexual sin and pornography and common law marriages and being shacked up with three or four different partners, maybe at the same time, who knows, swapped around, bred like cattle, and so on and so forth. You can imagine being converted out of that kind of background, the sorts of questions that they would be asking Paul. Where do I stand before God? Where do I stand before my partner? Should I get married? Should I have sexual relations if I'm in a marriage that was so ugly and putrid, and it was such a meaningless thing before I got married? Should that be something that's a part of my life, et cetera, et cetera? And you can maybe use your imagination to think of all of the kinds of issues that these people would have. Sincere questions. Where do I stand before God? These were not hypotheticals for them. These were not just made up, let me see if I can stump the Apostle Paul with this question. These were questions that were born out of their very circumstances of life. So they were desperate. That's how people come to us in our churches, isn't it? The Corinthian society out there out of which people are converted is an absolute mess. No respect for God, no respect for morality. And in many ways, no conscience of sinfulness. So you've got all kinds of sordid relationships out of which people are converted and come to Christ. The reason I'm making a fairly big deal about that is the church can't turn her back and say, well, you know, we just don't really deal with those kinds of situations. And by saying that, the church is admitting that we've got no answers. And more importantly, the church is saying God has no answers. The scriptures have no answers. And that's certainly not the case. So concerning the things that you wrote unto me, Paul begins this chapter and then he begins to respond to those things that they wrote to him about. Verses 1 and 2 deal with sex and the single person. Paul gives details enough at that point to help this single person understand how he or she is to conduct himself, and if you can't, then there is an option. Verses 3 through 5, Paul deals with married people. Where does that come into play in their life? In verses 6 and 7, Paul deals with singles and singleness. If you have the capacity, if you have the gift of singleness, then that gift needs to be exercised properly. Christ deals with the same issue in Matthew chapter 19 when he says, if you can receive this saying, then you need to receive it. So there is sort of an exception to God's general rule that he established way back in Genesis chapter 2 when he said, it's not good that man be alone. I will make him a helper that's suitable, that is complementary, and that completes him. That is the general rule. God has established an exception to that general rule. Because to some, he has given the gift of singleness. Now, the question is, how do I know if I have that gift? Pastor Mike made it clear yesterday, if you're married, you don't have it. But there is a process. There are questions. There is an evaluation of sorts that can be gone through to determine if that gift is mine. And I think Becca ran some copies off. I don't know if we still have some, but Becca ran some copies off of, I don't know, probably 10 or 12, maybe 15 questions that singles can ask. And you know, we joke sometimes about, well, she's an old maid, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, she's not married by 24. I'm going to be an old maid the rest of my life or whatever. Those kinds of, you know, nonsensical things. But the fact of the matter is, being single, if you have the gift, is just as legitimate as being married. As a matter of fact, being single, if you have the gift for singleness, you have more capacity and opportunities to serve Christ than a married person. Because you don't have to worry about that husband. Or you don't have to worry about that wife. You don't have children for responsibilities. You've got all kinds of time. Now let me be clear, the gift of singleness is not so you can become a millionaire by the time you're 35. It's not so that you can just give your life to, you know, secular pursuits and not have, you know, anything else to be concerned about. That's not the point that Paul is making, nor the point that Christ made in Matthew 19. If that gift is yours and it is biblical and it is legitimate, and some people do have that, it needs to be exercised for the kingdom of God, not for personal self-gain. So in verses 6 and 7, Paul deals with singles and singleness. One of the points that we made, I'll just throw it in, just maybe as a little bit of review, and for some of you that weren't here, as a little bit of a teaser, but in verses 1 and 2 and in verses 6 and 7, Paul deals with singles who have never been married. That's a pretty important component to this overall text. Singles who have never been married. Because in verses 8 and 9, he shifts gears. Because now he addresses a group of singles who have previously been married, but are no longer married. And in verse 8, they are now no longer married, either by the death of their former spouse or through divorce from a former spouse. Verses 10 and 11, Paul again shifts gears and deals with marriage between two believers. Now let me begin here and then we'll move on. In verse 10, it says, "And unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord." Just to sort of mark that mentally, what Paul is doing here is indicating that what he's about to say about this couple, this scenario, this particular situation, what Paul is about to say here in verses 10 and 11 is something that Jesus dealt with in the Gospels. Now, we're going to quickly move to verse 12 in a moment, but I wanted to make that distinction because in verse 12, Paul says, "But to the rest, I'm speaking, not the Lord." So what Jesus dealt with in the Gospels was not the end-all, do-all, final word about this comprehensive topic of marriage, divorce, and remarriage, because the teachings of Jesus was put in the context of covenantal marriage between two professing believers. What Paul is going to deal with beginning in verse 12 is marriage between a couple, one being a believer and the other being a non-believer. And what Paul says to the believing couple in verses 10 and 11, if you get a divorce, then stay divorced, stay single by divorce. And now he's not accommodating divorce, he's not commending divorce. He is saying, listen, if you get a divorce, stay that way so that at the end you can be reconciled to that wife or that husband because you have no biblical grounds to be divorced in the first place. Now we come to verse 12. I like to preach at Grace because you have plenty of time. That may bring groans from some and maybe cheers from a couple. A believer married to an unbeliever who wants to stay in the relationship. Now remember I mentioned that 1 through 16, Paul covers 7 different kinds of scenarios. Verse 1 and 2 is one kind, 3 through 5 is one kind, 6 and 7 is one kind, 8 and 9 is one kind, 10 and 11 is one kind, 12 through 16 is two additional kinds of scenarios. So let me just sort of back up and say that with all of those, and each one of those have twists and turns of their own. So let me just say how important it is to have proper, and I appreciate the emphasis Rick gave this morning about shepherd care, elder care, Hebrews 13, 17, those that care for our souls. It is important that those shepherds take this kind of teaching seriously, that they understand it, so they can bring the Word of God to bear, and even passages that help inform by principle, but may not speak directly to these issues. There are a myriad of principles that have to be thought through when we're working through case by case, the nuances and the twists and the turns of various kinds of situations like this. So in verses 12 through 14, we now come to this situation. Here is a believer married to an unbeliever, but the unbeliever is willing to stay. Now, what does that mean? Well, let me just throw out another teaser. What that does not mean is that I am going to absolutely destroy this marriage, but I still like your egg, so I'm going to stay at home. So we have a biblical marriage. X on that one. So we're not going to preach out of one side of our mouth what the theology of marriage is out of Genesis chapter 2 and what God has established as a permanent commitment, a covenant of companionship, a living together, a becoming one, being one in thought, one in action, one in priorities, one in ambition. We're not going to preach the theology of marriage and then out of the other corner of our mouth reduce marriage to geography. Well, as long as they're still living in the same, the four walls of a house, then that must be marriage. They can be as separated in four walls of a house just as well, and maybe even with more turmoil than they can if they lived on two sides of the world. So we're not going to establish God's theology of marriage and then, when the pressure's on, reduce it to some kind of geographical address and street number and zip code. We can't do that. Paul says, I'm speaking, not the Lord. We've talked about that already. This is no less authoritative than what Christ said. This just happens to be teaching that Christ did not cover. And it also sort of categorizes the teaching of Christ under the umbrella of believers, both believers in marriage. The exact circumstances here are not necessarily known. For example, it could have been a believer married to an unbeliever, a believer who chose to marry an unbeliever. We know that's sin, but it could be that situation. We don't know. It could be two unbelievers that were married before one of them was converted to Christ. We don't know. But the point is, we have a situation. And that's what Paul is trying to untangle. One is a believer, the other is an unbeliever. What does Paul say? Don't get a divorce. If the unbeliever wants to stay, then don't get a divorce. Stay together. Don't separate. That instruction is given to the wife if she has an unbelieving husband. That instruction is given to the husband if he has an unbelieving wife. If there is a willingness to stay in the marriage, and we'll say a little bit more about that in a moment, if they're willing to stay, then don't divorce. There's hope for the believer because he or she can please a non-believer in some ways. Maybe not every way, but in some ways. The believer is to do all she can to preserve the marriage, not break it up. And I'm going to qualify all she can or all he can. But the point is that if a believer is married to an unbeliever, the believer can't say, I'm getting sick and tired of this guy not going to church with me. I'm getting sick and tired of this woman not going to church with me. I want me a believing spouse. So I'm just going to make my home as miserable as I can so that maybe in 3 weeks this dude will just get out. That is not what this text is talking about. This is not the permission that this text is given. So the believing spouse has a ministry, and that is to live the grace life in front of this unbelieving spouse. Now, no believing spouse is going to perfectly live the grace life in front of any spouse. We know that, don't we, Sandra? Jeff struggles with living that grace life. What are some reasons for a believer married to an unbeliever that might want a divorce? Well, if a believer is sincere, they would probably like to have a Christian partner. Especially if both of them were unbelievers when they got married, and now one of them is converted to Christ. And man, things would sure be a lot neater around here if my partner was saved. So there's nothing wrong necessarily with that kind of desire. He or she may want to be able to pray with their spouse. I mean, I guess you could go through the words, but obviously an unbeliever's prayer means nothing. Not connecting to anybody, and probably wouldn't want to anyway. So, you know, that might be a reason. She may want to share things in life on a spiritual level. Struggles that maybe her husband or his wife could pray with them about and encourage them and bring scripture to bear on issues and so forth. So there's a lot of, and we're just trying to be a little bit practical here, there may be a lot of reasons that this believing husband may really wish that his wife would come to Christ. Pragmatic reasons, I mean, other than the glory of God, which obviously should be the reason, and so that in the ages to come he might show the exceeding riches of his kindness to her as well as him through Christ. So we understand that the ultimate goal and the ultimate motive is the glory of God and the extension of God's grace and eternal praise and worship to the Lamb. We understand that, but on a practical, you know, I'd like to ask him to pray for breakfast once in a while, or her. You know, I'd like to see him or her write out the giving check. And I'm not the one with the pressure. So we understand that there's practical, you know, down in the weeds of life kind of issues that, you know, a believing spouse may just wish, man, you know, life would sure be a lot simpler if my spouse were a believer. So I'll devise me a plan. I'll get rid of that girl so I can get me a believing wife. Okay, so we've been a little silly about that, but you get the point. That's not what Paul is talking about. The believer has responsibilities. The believer has a ministry to live by grace, to live with grace, to live graciously. One of my pastor friends was counseling a man one time that professed Christ, professed that the doctrines of grace were the very core of his being. I mean, you know, maybe his middle name was Calvin. I'm being silly about that. But I mean, that was how fervent he was about that. But he was sitting in a counseling session with his wife, who he had been very rude and ugly and so on and so forth to. And the question was this to that man: how can you, who profess to be so committed to the doctrines of grace, be so graceless in your marriage? Kaboom. We can't just make it academic, can we? If we believe in the doctrines of grace, then we need to be living the grace of those doctrines. So this unbelieving wife, this believing husband has the privileges to be able to do that. So they have responsibilities, they have a ministry. It even says in the text that the unbelieving spouse is sanctified by the believing spouse. Now, we have to understand that not in a redemptive sense, not in a redemptive context, but in a very special context. This unbelieving spouse has a front row in the theater of what does it look like for a believer who professes Christ to live that grace life in front of them. They've got a front row seat. What does it look like to live this way under pressure from an unbelieving spouse? What does it look like to live this way under ridicule and sarcasm and constant barrages of criticism? How does it look to live that way in front of an unbeliever? Now, do we knock it out of the park all the time? Probably not. But that's the privilege of this unbeliever, to be able to see. And by the same token, Paul brings the situation in of those who have children in that context. And that wife that believes, or that husband that believes, has the opportunity to say, children, I know I'm not perfect, but this is what it looks like to live under oppressive authority. This is what it looks like to live under a wife who is constantly ragging on me because she doesn't think that I'm the kind of leader that I need to be, and she's the one that's an unbeliever. Here's how you respond to that. So those children have a front row seat right beside, as it were, that unbelieving spouse to watch, as it were, on display, what it looks like for a believer to live by grace to the glory of God in that kind of context. And I might say that's not easy. That's got to be. I mean, it's one thing to live and function before an unreasonable boss, as hard as that may be. That's got to be tough. And it may be difficult for a believing child to live that way under a married child who is a believer, to live that way in front of maybe unbelieving parents that they see occasionally, monthly, biannually, or whatever. But to live daily under the microscope of sarcasm, the microscope of sadistic kind of evaluation. Oh, you think, you say you're a Christian, and ooh, look at this, and poke there, and poke there. Well, demonstrating more and more the unbelief of that person that's living that way because of the non-grace, the non, you know, the unkindness, the non-loving response, just demonstrating day after day after day. But the pressure is there nonetheless, so it just ramps up the privilege and responsibility of that believing spouse to live the way as a testimony. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 6 deals that specifically with a believing wife before an unbelieving husband. But folks, it also gives the church the opportunity to come alongside this believing spouse and encourage and let her or him know that you're praying for them. Because you know it's got to be absolute misery daily. Let me take just a few minutes, because it's important in verse, let me go back and just look specifically here. Verse 12, but to the rest I speak not the Lord, if the brother hath a wife who believeth not, and she be pleased to dwell with him. What does that mean? Again, being silly a few minutes ago, it's not, okay, I'm going to make this marriage an absolute mess, but you know, I still like the fact that you bring home a paycheck. So I ain't leaving. I'm going to absolutely destroy you as best I can. I am going to turn you upside down, sideways, every way I can. But, you know, I like the fact that you've got a pretty good retirement program and we've got good insurance. So I'm going to stay within these four walls. Let me just say that is not what Paul means, pleased to dwell with him or her. I mean, an unbeliever would be a fool to give that up, right? A free ticket, good insurance, you know, fat paycheck maybe, you know, free rent. I mean, an unbeliever would be a fool to give that up. That's not what Paul is talking about. Why? Because there's more to marriage than that. The theology of marriage as laid out in Genesis chapter 2 at the beginning, and then that flows through the entire sweep of the Bible, it's more than living in four walls. It's more than an address. It's more than a zip code. It's more than just wanting a free ride in life. So what does that mean? Because there is an if there. If she be pleased to dwell with him. Verse 12 speaks of the unsaved wife. Verse 13 speaks of the unsaved husband. The same word, the same phraseology is used. It's just giving both sides of the same coin. It may be a mixed marriage where the husband's an unbeliever. It may be a mixed marriage where the wife is an unbeliever. If the unbeliever, husband or wife, is pleased to dwell, then we don't pursue a divorce. The word pleased comes from a compound or two Greek words, one meaning together, joint working, cooperation, one meaning well pleased or to think something good. It's not merely an understanding of what is right and good, but stressing the willingness and the freedom of an intention or resolve regarding that. I am willing, I am pleased, I am content, I am satisfied to be here. That is a good thing. I am pleased to dwell here. I'm not chafing every day. I'm not saying with my mouth, yeah, I want to stay, saying with my action, you big jerk, I wish I'd never married you in the first place. That's not being pleased. Robertson's word pictures says she is content. He says it's a compound verb, to be pleased together, to agree together. Now, obviously, there's going to be certain things that an unsaved spouse and a saved spouse are not going to be able to agree on. But let's face it, there are a lot of things that can be agreed on. We're not going to throw dishes at each other. I mean, we can agree on that. We can live civilly together. We can cooperate in divvying out finances and so on and so forth. I'm not going to intentionally make life an abject, miserable situation for you. So there's a lot of things that can be agreed on. Vincent Word Study says to be pleased means to be content and to give consent. Vincent says there is agreement indicated. So this pleased business indicates at least a measure of contentment, a measure of willing cooperation. So we've got to understand what Paul is saying here, prefaced with that word if there is this. The word dwell, by the way, I skipped this other definition. I think it's important. Thayer's Greek definition says to be pleased together with, to approve together, to be pleased at the same time, to consent or to agree to. So it's pretty clear what pleased means. Dwell in Romans 7:20 speaks of indwelling sin. In 1 Corinthians 3 it speaks of the Spirit of God indwelling the church. In Romans 8, 9, and 11, it speaks of the Spirit of God indwelling believers. And in 1 Timothy 6, 16, it speaks of God dwelling in light. So in light of these uses and the following definitions, it can't simply mean to exist in one house. So again, we're not going to reduce being pleased to dwell with to geography. As I've mentioned before, we're not going to preach biblical theology of marriage out of one side of our mouth, and out of the other reduce the idea to a street address. Well, the church must step in to help this believing spouse who is, should be, parentheses I'll say should be, because why? Because believers belong in church, unbelievers don't. So this church family, and I'm not just saying this as in Grace Bible Fellowship, but whatever church family, this believing spouse who is married to an unbelieving spouse belongs, the church must step in, the leaders must step in and help them evaluate if there's struggles, if there's pressure, if there's contemplation of a potential divorce. Let's sit down and talk about this, because we have to determine, is your unbelieving spouse pleased to dwell with you? And under what conditions, and what does that look like? If you've concluded that he or she is not, then let us help you as the leaders, as the authority in the church, let us help you determine whether or not that is indeed what's going on. So we can't ignore that. We can't just pass over that glibly. The word dwell, Vine's Expository Dictionary of New Testament Words, says to inhabit as one's abode. Wiest Word Study says to dwell means to be at home. John Gill, commenting on the phrase, and she be pleased to dwell with him, says, loves her husband, chooses to continue with him. This is describing the attitude and actions of the unbelieving spouse. There is actually a desire to be there. There is a want to be there. There is a contentment of being there. although imperfect as it may be, with a believer and an unbeliever in this relationship. Dwelling with the individual in a close relationship is the issue. It's not merely just existing within four walls. It's not just having a home-cooked meal or splitting the rent and so forth. So having said all of that, verses 12 through 14 essentially say, if you have a believer married to an unbeliever and that unbeliever wants to stay, then don't get a divorce. There are ways that that can happen, and you probably know couples, families that have that kind of dynamic going on. I can think of one now where a lady has lived with an unbelieving husband, as far as I know, unless God saved him, for decades. And it seems to have worked okay. So the fact of the matter that Paul is dealing with this is indicative of the fact that it can work. Though not perfectly, because this believing spouse certainly is grieved and concerned and prays for and would love for God to redeem her or his unbelieving spouse. But it can happen. And if there's no indications from the unbeliever that I want out, I'm leaving, I'm messing this thing up, I'm busting up what God's put together, then Paul says, then don't get a divorce. But here things change. We're going to have to speed up a little bit. I know our time's getting away from us. And I know y'all probably thought only maybe 10 minutes have passed, but a little bit more time than that. 15 and 16, Paul shifts gears, established for us another scenario, though the same dynamics going on in a sense, an unbelieving spouse and a believing spouse. But in this scenario, the unbelieving spouse wants to leave. Now again, I know I'm being redundant. It's not just I want to pack my bags and walk out the door. Now that may be part of the indication, but we're not going to reduce it to that. Because it doesn't say she wants or he wants to leave the house, or he or she wants to leave the breakfast table, or he or she wants to leave the paycheck, or he or she wants to leave the barn in the backyard, or it's he or she wants to leave the marriage. And let me be quick to say again that you can leave the marriage and still live under the same roof. And you can make it very clear that you want to leave that marriage. And you say, Brother Hill, you're a little bit exercised over this. Well, maybe I am, because I'm telling you, the background that I've come through, the years that I've spent in fundamental churches, the kinds of nonsense that I've heard fundamental preachers communicate. One of my mentors that I would claim as a mentor made the statement, he's since died and gone to be with the Lord, but he made the statement one time, one of the most dangerous places for a divorced woman to be is on the pew of a fundamental church. There was reasons for him to say it, because there's no soul care. There's no helping that lady work through the nuances and maneuver through the circumstances of her situation. It's just been, we don't deal with divorce. We don't marry divorced people. Now, you can tithe. We won't keep you from that. I mean, you can pack it on, give to missions, etc. We'll take that. Now, you can't sing in the choir, you can't teach Sunday school. You know, we don't want you to influence anybody. We'll take your money. And I'll just be honest with you, I'm sick up to here of that. That's not what the scriptures teach. That's not shepherding people.